Good morning and welcome. Good to see you here. Greetings to those upstairs at the O1, Grays Lake, Highland Park, Crossroads. So I'm hoping to channel Toto, the little dog that was made famous in The Wizard of Oz, marched down the Yellow Brick Road with his friends. No desire on my part to be, captured by the wicked neighbor who turns into the witch. And I certainly don't want to be carried away by the flying monkeys that scarred me when I was about 4 and saw it for the first time. After you've seen The Wizard of Oz, 10 times and you're 15, you start to cheer for the flying monkeys. You sort of hope that they win. But when I was 4, it was quite traumatic. So I have no desire to be Toto in that sense. But what I do want to do, to the extent that I can, is pull back the curtain and expose the wizard. The wizard had sort of presented himself as this all-powerful, inspiring person that needed to be feared, all this awe and reverence that was given to the wizard. And then Toto pulls back the screen and it becomes obvious, oh, the wizard is just this somewhat bumbling old circus con man who's got a few magic tricks. And I say this all by way of saying that what I'm hoping that we can do over the course of the next 6 weeks is understand better the idols of our age, the small g gods that present themselves as being very powerful and deserving of our time and attention. All of this rolls out of our study of the book of Exodus. So we started back in August with Exodus, and I said this is a really big, important, significant book. It's the second book of the Bible. It is having, I think it's safe to now say, it's having a Caitlin Clark moment. Exodus is suddenly everywhere. I noted that it sprung onto the scene. That it wasn't just pastors that were talking about Exodus, but it was radio hosts, and it was public intellectuals, and it was philosophy professors. Everybody suddenly started writing books about Exodus and doing multi-series podcasts on Exodus, because Exodus was focusing on the big questions of the moment, which is partly, what does it mean to be free? How do I interact with the law? How do you create a culture that is actually going to survive? And all of those things are being answered in the book of Exodus. So it's the second book. This is the 25th sermon in Exodus to date. And in the first half, if you were here, you know that the first half of the book is all about how to get the Jews out of Egypt. So they were slaves, and we get introduced to Moses and Pharaoh and God and the burning bush, and you've got the 10 plagues and Passover, and then you've got the parting of the Red Sea and manna from heaven and all that. And lots of action in the first half of the book, and then we pivoted to the second half of the book where things quiet down, and now you have a lot about how you're going to get Egypt out of the Jews. So first it was to get the Jews out of Egypt. Now it's to get Egypt out of the Jews. So there's a lot of talk about worship. There's a lot of discussion about the tabernacle. So Moses has spent a long time up the mountain getting these detailed instructions, shockingly detailed instructions from God about how to build this tabernacle, because the whole idea is to sort of help the Jews understand that God is going to show up and live in the middle of their life. And how do you approach God and how do you interact with God, and all that is part of the part of what's informing the design of the tabernacle. So we're now in chapter 32, and we're going to start this extended little session that leverages the golden calf. So Moses is up in the mountain for 40 days, and 40 is a biblical number. It reflects a time of testing, right? It rained for 40 days. Jesus was out fasting and wrestling with the devil for 40 days. 40 is a number, so it symbolizes testing. The Jews are being tested. Moses is gone. Aaron is in charge, and the people fail the test, is what happens. And so they're impatient. They want things to happen more quickly than they're going to happen. And so they say to Aaron, who's been left in charge, Moses and Joshua and some other leaders have all gone up, partway up the mountain. Moses has gone the furthest up the mountain. But Aaron has been left in charge. And the people say to Aaron, it's sort of a famous, iconic line, up and make us gods. So it's a little, the whole passage here gets lots of discussion among scholars and theologians because it's unclear as to whether we're talking about make us a god or make us gods. And are they going to be violating the first commandment, which is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the home of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me. It's all about worshiping the right God. Or are they breaking the second commandment, which is about no idols or graven images or representations of God or things in heaven? So are they worshiping the right God the wrong way? Because when when Aaron finishes making the golden calf, he's going to say, behold, your God who brought you out of Egypt. So is this just supposedly a representation of Yahweh, or is this something new? It's all a little bit confusing, but what happens is the people say to Aaron, hey, up and make us gods. We don't know what happened to Moses. Time to move on. We want something to worship. And so Aaron asks for the gold that they have. Because remember, as they are leaving Egypt after the 10 plagues, that the last plague was the death of the firstborn male, and the Egyptians want the Jews to leave, and so they give them money. Here, take our gold and leave. So they had this gold. It was supposed to be used for the tabernacle and then later the temple. But he says, give me your gold. And so they give him the gold, and he then melts it down, and he fashions it into a calf, which is a very Egyptian thing to do. The Egyptians had at least 3 cow gods. And so it's clear we're not getting Egypt out of the Jews just yet, so they say, make us a god. And so he fashions this, and they go, great. And then there's this thing that says, okay, I'm going to build an altar for it. And then the next day, we're going to have this big festival. And we're going to worship this, and there's going to be lots of food and alcohol. And it says, and then they engaged in revelry. And the word revelry in Hebrew has got sexual connotations. So it's just this debauched, big party that they engage in with sort of the Egyptian fertility cults. And so you just got lots of, it's bad. So God, meanwhile, Moses is up on the mountain meeting with God, getting the blueprints for the tabernacle. God says to Moses, oh, by the way, you should know what's going on down in the camp. And he tells him, and he says, God says to Moses, I think I'm just going to wipe them all out, and I'll start all over with you. And Moses intercedes for the people. If you've remembered nothing so far from this series, this is, again, the 25th sermon, I hope that part of what you have heard is that throughout the book of Exodus, all these things that are happening, the names of God and the priests and the sacrifices, all these things are pointing ahead to Jesus. And so we have here Moses doing a very Jesus thing and saying, no, take me if you must, but leave them, right? Do not start over. And then he runs down the mountain, and in quick order, he sort of takes over again. First of all, he throws down the Ten Commandments. He's got 2 tablets that God had carved with his own hand. He throws them down, and they shatter. And then he takes the golden calf, and he pounds it down, and he melts it down, and he grinds the gold, and then he puts it in the water, and he makes them drink it, apparent out of control in terms of discipline. Makes them drink it, and then he goes to Aaron, and he says, I left you in charge, and Aaron just completely folds. He goes, they made me, and I didn't actually make the calf. It just sort of happened. And I mean, just complete weak, nothing leadership out of Aaron, and he blames everybody else. And then Moses goes to the Levites, who are the priests, and he gets the Levites to go, and they discipline the people, and some of them are killed, and all that happens. And then Moses runs back up the mountain to intercede with God. So we're looking at this, to understand our own lives. And some of you are thinking, well, you know, it's not like I'm perfect, but I'm feeling pretty safe on this front because I don't worship any idols, no golden calves, no jade statues, no totem poles, whatever. I just don't go down that path. So I want to say that, yes, you're probably safe if that's what the point is. But no, we're not safe because actually idolatry is a huge topic. And the idols of our age are not the idols of that time. In Acts chapter 17, the Apostle Paul has a little interface with the people in Athens. So Paul is on his second missionary journey, and Paul has done what Paul does. He's gone into a town, he started a church, he'd gone into the synagogues, preached, started a church, and then started a riot, and ended up, you know, getting beat up and put in prison and all that stuff. That's what Paul did, basically. You know, the joke pastors tell us, you know, Paul preaches, they riot, I preach, they go to sleep. But anyway, Paul had a pattern of starting riots and moving on, and they have asked Paul to leave. His handlers have said, okay, Paul, move, go to Athens and wait for us, and don't mess up, don't do anything wrong. We're going to clean up the mess here. We'll be there in a few days. So Paul has walked around, he spent a day walking around Athens, and he's seen all these idols, and including an idol to an unknown god. And Paul, being Paul, starts, you know, steps up and goes to the theater. He goes, hey, I see you're very religious, but you don't really know what you're doing. Let me tell you about who God is. And he starts to then attack their idols. And I've long thought that it would be really helpful if instead of Paul showing up in Mars Hill in the first century and attacking the idols of first century Greece, that Paul showed up at Union Station, downtown Chicago, and looked around and said, oh, let me tell you what your idols are, right? Let me help you understand how you are doing this wrong. So I'm not claiming to be Paul here, but actually, once you sort of study and you study history and you look around and you read the sociologists and you start to compare cultures, you go, oh, these are the idols of our culture in our age. And so over the next 6 weeks, we want to look at them. And I'll just say, just right out of the gate, the idols of our age are almost all good things. They just are not ultimate things. And we try to make them ultimate things. And when we do that, we get in trouble. So I want to make 4 points today. I want to step back, and I'm just laying the foundation for the rest of the series when we're going to look at the idols of our age. So the first thing I want to say is, we were created to worship, and we do. Okay? We were created by God to worship. That is our purpose. We were given control of things. We're placed at the... none of the other animals are made in the image of God. We are God's co-regents of creation. We're supposed to be overseeing things and leading things and stewarding things. And in all of that, we're to do that in a way that reflects God and his character and his goodness. And the problem is, like, we jumped the track. In an effort to become more like God, we actually became much less like God. We are now broken. We are fallen. We are sinful. We are bent. All kinds of different terms get used here. The problem is we don't worship God. We worship other things. We worship ourselves. We worship science, we worship entertainment, we worship money, we worship sex, we worship our country, we worship all kinds of things. And for the most part, these are all good things. They're just, again, not ultimate things. So one of the things you need to understand is that you worship, right? It's a given. We don't fully know what is meant by the fact that we're made in the image of God. The Imago Dei sometimes is the way it's described. But we know that we are somehow qualitatively different than all of the other animals. We reflect the image of God. So theologians will debate what this is, in part because we debate how much of the image of God is left after the fall. So when sin enters the world, everything's broken, all of creation suffers under the curse. And so we don't know how much of the image of God is left in us, but people will say, you see the image of God because people like beauty. They like music. We laugh. We do all kinds of things. This is part of what it means to be made in the image of God. Okay, so maybe not. We don't know. But one of the things that is clearly true about us that is not true about the other animals is we worship. So if you know how to listen for this, you hear it all the time. He's the goat, the greatest of all time. She was brilliant in that role. This car is the most elegant piece of engineering marvel you'll ever find. I couldn't live without my iPhone, right? I mean, all of those are statements of worship. We're just describing real value to something, and we're saying, this is great, this is good. We worship. You see people. They're not told when they're at a basketball game or they're at a Cubs game or at the theater or something. They're not told that you need to applaud. They applaud. You cheer. You dance. You sing the fight song. You jump up and down. You're excited when somebody does something on your team. There's a sense in which that's just worship. Like, we are excited and moved, and we are adding our voice to those that are celebrating something. So the Bible never tells us to worship. It tells us to worship God. It's a given that we're going to worship, right? We have no option but to worship. The question is, what are we worshiping? So, first point, you're made to worship and you're going to. The second point is that we're broken and we end up worshiping the wrong things. The third point is that the Bible refers to wrongly directed worship as idolatry. And this is, some would say it's the second, it's the largest topic in the Old Testament. I don't know that I would go that far, but you see it a lot. Idolatry shows up in Genesis. In Exodus, we're in Exodus 32. You got the golden calf. You've got commandments prohibiting idolatry because it's such a problem. In the Psalms, Psalm 115, you've got Psalms that call out idolatry. There it says, you know, it's declaring that people make idols. They carve statues out of stone and then worship these statues. The statues have eyes but cannot see and ears but cannot hear. It's describing a dumb idol. Isaiah 44 has got a statement where Isaiah, speaking for God, says, you take a board, you take a tree, and with half of it you carve an idol, and with half of it you have wood in order to cook your meal. Like, what are you doing? Think about what you're doing. This does not make any sense. And so there's a lot in the Old Testament that is saying, don't worship things that you make, right? Don't ascribe ultimate value to these things that don't have ultimate value. Then in the New Testament, we get lots of statements against idolatry. We see Paul and will write to the Corinthians and tell them to flee from idolatry. John will end his first letter, 1 John, with a plea that they should avoid idolatry. We got in Colossians, they're told don't worship angels. I mean, there's just all this stuff about directing worship. And then we have lots of examples in history of worship going on. Augustine, in his book, City of God, he's writing as Rome is falling, the Roman Empire is falling, and lots of people are blaming the Christians, because Christianity has spread in the first few hundred years, and as Christians have sort of spread throughout the Roman Empire, now Rome is falling, and some people are blaming Christians for the fact that Rome is falling. And so Paul writes this big apologetic for Christianity, and he says, among other things, that Rome is not falling because of Christians. Christians are actually very good citizens. You don't even realize what you're doing. Let me do. And one of the things that he holds up to them is he goes, "You conquer some group, and the first thing that you do is you then start to worship their idols. Like the idols didn't even work. Like they didn't win the battle, but you now take these idols and you start to worship them. And then John Calvin will write, and he'll say a famous line that the human heart is an idol-making factory. We are forever creating idols. We are forever finding something to organize our life around, something that is good, but not ultimate, not God, and we give it too much credibility. So it's important to understand that when we're looking at idols, we're looking at good things for the most part. So there are ways in which good things become bad things. But for the most part, we're going after things that we believe to be good. So evil has a great PR department. Evil is always advertising that it's fun and exciting and sexy and dynamic. And good tends to, people think of good as being boring and obedient and it's not very original. The reality is the opposite is true. Evil is boring, unoriginal, repetitive, and it's not, there's no life there. Good, real good, is original and dynamic and fun and pulls us forward. Evil is just broken good, right? I mean, evil, you read Screwtape Letters, Lewis makes this point brilliantly, that evil is just something good broken that you're advertising as being better than it is. And so we see the downside of evil, I think, pretty easily with addictions. Addictions promise more than they deliver. They end up demanding more and more and returning less and less until pretty soon an addict is giving everything to something and getting nothing out of it. And there's a sense in which that's just a metaphor for evil. So for the most part, there are people that sort of celebrate evil and go after evil, but this doesn't go anywhere for very long. For the most part, the idols of our age are good things. They're gifts from God. They're wonderful, good things. They're just not ultimate things. And so what we get in Scripture is counsel saying that you cannot make an idol. You cannot worship things that are idols because they're ultimately not going to deliver. So need to understand that God tells us to not worship idols because some idols can work for 40 or 50 years. Right? You can just keep thinking, oh, you know what? This is good because it's not bad. It's just not ultimate. And you think, I'll be satisfied when I get X. And whatever X is a certain amount of money. Then X comes and X isn't enough. You need a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And it can just lead you on until you get, at some point you go, you know, I don't think X is ever, I don't even think 10X is ultimately going to do it. Because we have, to quote Pascal, the God-shaped vacuum in our heart. And there is nothing big enough to fill that hole in our heart except for God. And so we need to seek God. And so what we're going to do in this series is, for the most part, we're going to play defense. And that is, we want to look at these good things, but try and look at them a little bit objectively and dispassionately so we can see, oh, that's good, but that's not ultimate, right? And this is the path that it's leading me down. And these are the promises this makes that it can't ultimately deliver. But there's also a need to not just play defense, but also to play offense. And that means we've got to look at God. So the first 15 years I was on staff here, I was also leading a group. Then it was called CISF, Christian International Scholarship Foundation. It's now called Scholar Leaders International. It's gotten a lot bigger. And leading this group meant that, among other things, I had meetings in Africa. And when each of my boys turned 12, I would take them on one of these consultations that I was going to on to Africa. And, you know, the consultation they found remarkably boring. I mean, it's a theological meeting, you know. I mean, it is what it was. But at night, or then for a couple days afterwards, we would do things in Africa. And with our third son, Jason, I finally decided we were going to go visit the Nairobi Animal Orphanage. So Nairobi is not that far from, you know, the bush, the jungle. And animals, of course, kill each other and eat each other. And there would be people that would find, you know, lion cubs or, you know, whatever. The mother has been killed, and you've got these animal orphans. So they would bring them into the orphanage, care for them. Some of them they could release, some of them they couldn't, whatever. So you've got this orphanage. And I kept hearing about it, like, oh, yeah, go to the animal orphanage. And one year we'd gone to the zoo. And they go, no, you don't want to go to the zoo, you want to go to the orphanage. So if you go to Nairobi, I would recommend that you go to the animal orphanage. But just understand, you'll never go to a zoo again, because the experience is radically different. So I am literally, we've got out of the taxi, I am paying the taxi driver, and Jason is, you know, gone off and gone about 20 feet away, and I turn around to see him, and he's now surrounded by orangutans that have jumped out of the tree, sort of landed at his feet, and rolled to this garbage can. They're rifling through the garbage can. And I'm like, and there's like 10 of them. And I'm like, are they going to attack us? What's going to happen? I don't know anything about this. So no one tells the animals they have to stay in their area. And so they leave all the time. Everything is everywhere. And then the few of the animals that they don't let out, they let you in. So we've got this guide, and he goes, you know what, you want to get a picture of your son petting a panther? I'm like, no. He goes, oh, yeah, everybody does it. You know, let's fine. So after about a half hour watching everybody else go in and pet the panther, I'm like, okay, Jay, go pet the panther. And while I'm getting ready to take the picture, I said, you ever have any problems? Like, this is, like, so crazy. There's so many lawsuits that would be happening if we were in the U.S. right now. Can't even get close to this. I said, do you ever have any problems? He goes, no, the only time you have problems with the panthers is if the orangutans are out. I'm like, the orangutans are out. What am I doing here? Oh, my goodness. So it was an amazing time. At the end, we go to this row of cages where they have the young lions, the lion cubs and the younger lions. And I said to the guide that we had with us, I said, so I think I've been hearing some of these lions roar. And he goes, no, you haven't. And I go, I think so. He goes, yeah, everybody thinks that they're hearing a lion roar. He goes, I've been here all day. He goes, you have not heard a lion roar. He goes, when a lion roars, he goes, every animal in the zoo is going to panic. And he said, occasionally at night, there will be lions, full-grown lions that are out, you know, a couple hundred yards, because they can smell what's going on, and they'll come here. And he goes, and they will roar. And he goes, and once you've heard a lion roar, you don't go, is that a lion or not? No, you know it. So I just want to say that part of what we need to do is we need to get closer to the lion so we don't get fooled by the hyenas and the other animals that are the idols, the lesser gods, right? So we're going to play defense. We're going to try and understand what we're up against better. But we also want to play offense, because you have a God-shaped vacuum in your heart, right? And nothing else is going to fill it but God. And there's a lot of things that will look like they're going to fill it for a while, but you were made to worship. And ultimately, that worship needs to be directed to God. So I'm going to invite the campus pastors to come forward. And what we're going to do as we begin to pivot towards communion is I am going to invite you to join with us in a collective prayer of confession. Because the fact of the matter is, we are idol worshipers and we are idol creators. And we need to own that. We need to confess that. And so we're going to have a corporate prayer of confession, and then that will be followed by moving into communion. Please stand.